Director, and I want to thank you for joining us for our spring 2014 Philson Public Conference entitled A Nation of Immigrants, How the Introduction of New Cultures Changed American Society Between 1820 to the Present. At this time, I want to introduce our first lecture, Immigration Without Restriction, 1820 to 1880. Hasia Diner is the Paul S. and Sylvia Steinberg Professor of American Jewish History at New York University, with a joint appointment in the Departments of History and the Skirball Department of Hebrew and Judaic Studies, as well as Director of the Goldstein-Gorin Center for American Jewish History. She received her Ph.D. in history from the University of Illinois Chicago. She is the author of many books, including We Remember with Reverence and Love, American Jews and the Myth of Silence After the Holocaust, 1945 to 1962. Professor Diner, thank you very much for being here today.
Okay, I want to take 1 minute first to thank Judy Miller. Judy, are you here? She may be running around. Yes, there she is, coming up. So I want to thank Judy for having tracked me down and convinced me to not only come and speak, but to bring a number of my colleagues. And so while I'm honored to have followed the congressman, I'm equally honored to precede my respected peers and fellow scholars from the field of American ethnic and immigration history. So, and thank you all for being here. So I'm going to be looking at and sharing with you some thoughts about the history of immigration to the United States from the 1820s through the 1880s, which I entitled Immigration Without Restriction, but you'll see it's actually a little bit more complicated than that. This is a period in American immigration history which many historians have kind of glided over, and they want to get on to the great age of the 1880s and beyond, and kind of see this period as somehow less interesting, less fraught with the same kinds of tensions and concerns of later periods. It's certainly an era that after the 1880s and 1890s, as anti-immigration sentiment came to become highly organized, ideological, and racially based, and nationally based, this is a period that was looked back upon nostalgically and romantically as the era of the good immigration. Indeed, it came to be called the old immigration, which was in direct contrast to the new, that is, post-1880s, and the new being bad, and the old being good. The immigrants of the old immigration from the 1820s through the 1880s were viewed in American rhetoric and American ideology, again, at the end of the 19th and into the 20th century, as made up of hardworking, freedom-loving women and men inspired by the promise of liberty as individuals in search of personal independence. They were permanent, that is, they were coming with a commitment to America. They were heavily bound for agriculture. They were the bearers of a culture that was close to American Anglo-based culture, and as such would blend in very well with their American neighbors. They would become part of the American body politics. But in fact, it is much more complicated immigration than that. That tells us nothing about the immigrants themselves and their experiences and their interactions with Americans during their period of immigration, but rather tells us about what late 19th and early 20th century Americans, thought about the immigrants of their own era. So I want to tell a much more complex story about the immigrants who came in those decades of the early to mid-19th century. And we'll see that, in fact, they shared many characteristics of those who would follow after them, and not just in the, and you look at the program, how we've organized this chronologically, they shared much not only with those who migrated from the 1820s, from the 1880s through the 1920s, but indeed share much with the immigrants who are coming to the United States today. And all of the issues that are part of the contemporary discussion in American society about immigration were there starting in the 1820s. And what I want to explore in my remarks is I refer to and focus on, for one thing, the economic basis of this migration, rather than seeing these women and men as freedom-loving people coming for personal freedom and sort of inspired by American ideals of liberty. They were like those who followed men and women in search of work. Their migration was embedded in a global context, no different than the global context which shapes migration today. How they migrated and where they migrated to and where they left reflected state policies, both in the place of origin and in the place of destination. Like the women and men arriving today, whether legally or illegally, and I like to always put those words in quote marks, and I can do kind of air quotes here, they created ethnic communities, enclaves in which individuals, through their families and friendship networks, sought to create modes of life in America that were both links to the places they left, but incorporated American idioms and American realities. Finally, in terms of what makes that era so similar to today's immigration and all the immigrations in between, is that the immigrants from the 1820s through the 1880s spawned anti-immigrant movements, which in turn we can think of as having at their core fear of subversion. That is, a view that these were dangerous people, shaped heavily by religious hatred, okay, religious fears, concerned that immigrants were undermining the American economy by depressing the wages of, in quotes again, real Americans, that these immigrants would never become American, okay, that they were going to remain unacculturated and rooted in their immigrant enclaves and would never enter into the American mainstream. And finally, that race came to be a defining characteristic. So for the time I have today, I want to begin with the issue of time, since as a historian, that's ultimately what I'm most interested in. Why the 1820s? After all, we can look back to the pre-1820 period to see that immigration was always an issue in British North America and in the early Republic. In a way, all Americans, other than the indigenous people, were immigrants. Famously, Franklin Roosevelt in the 1930s addressed the Daughters of the American Republic, people who were able to document their ancestry back to the soldiers of the American Revolution, and he, the descendant of immigrants in the colonial period from the Netherlands, began his address to the fairly anti-immigrant Daughters of the American Republic by saying, fellow immigrants. So even in the colonial period, immigration was a major factor. Certainly, I have to say that when I think about immigration, I do exclude from my analysis the issue of the of slavery and the slave trade, inasmuch as women and men brought to the United States, to the colonies and to America as slaves were individuals with no choice. That is, they didn't decide when to go, where to go, how to go, to stay or not to stay. Theirs was one without personal volition. And so America in the pre-national period and the pre-1820 period had always been plagued by labor shortages, and the British and then the Americans after the 1780s were concerned with how to find people to come to do the basic work to fuel economic development. But we begin in the 1820s because it is at that point when we begin to see the beginnings of what we might call mass migration. So a mass migration is a continuous process. Certainly there were years of heavier migration and years of lower migration, but continuous nonetheless. Mass migrations involve diverse groups of immigrants all coming to the same place. So the numbers were tremendous. They impacted both the sending and the receiving societies. The existence of friends and family in some new setting becomes a factor in and of itself in stimulating mass migration. In eras of mass migration, all institutions of both the sending and the receiving society are shaped by migration. So that is, America after the 1820s cannot be understood without knowing, without thinking about the fact that immigrants were arriving in large numbers. So in this period from the 1820s and beyond, we see at work a set of forces and a pattern in which migration came to shape the places people were leaving and the places that they were going to. From in terms of the places they were leaving, we can say regardless of the name of the country or the name of the region from which they left, immigrants were coming from very specific places where a growing number of people, young people in the main, and immigrants are almost always young people, a growing proportion of the young population was either unable, unwilling, or uninterested in staying put because of changing economic conditions in their place of origin. That is, the places where they lived could no longer accommodate what was essentially a growing population. These were young people searching for opportunities to get on with life. There were, throughout the places from which immigrants left, a decline in traditional ways of making a living, at the same time that improvements in technology of transportation and communication made it possible to leave. The development of the economy of transportation, in particular, facilitated the mass movement of one place to another. Likewise, laws in the place of origin began to allow people to leave, while laws and developments in the place of destination made it possible for them to enter. This was true of all times in the history of American immigration. This one, not unlike those that would follow. Now, it's also important to note that even in this era where there were few restrictions, the issue of illegality was always present. In the 19th century, it was more common that the illegality was that people were leaving places illegally rather than arriving illegally. So in countries which had, mandatory military service for men, we see vast numbers of young men evading conscription by coming to America. In other words, that became a way to get out of what was viewed by many as an odious way to make a living. Okay. Likewise, and I'll be turning to this in a few minutes, some American states began to put in place laws, starting even in the before the beginning of the 19th century, that required that ship's captains prove that everybody on the ship, or that nobody on the ship, would become, quote, a public charge. okay, because they didn't want immigrants coming in and taking up community resources, the almshouse, and so on. And so all sorts of informal means were devised by immigrants to evade these, and by the ship's captains, to evade these laws. So even when there were minimal laws, illegality was always there. Okay, well, let me offer some of the empirical details of this time and this immigration. For one thing, between 1820 and 1860, about 5 million Europeans came to the United States. Between 1860 and 1880 and the Civil War years marked a lull in migration, and not surprisingly, because so many of the immigrants would have been young men who would have found themselves once again liable for conscription. So between 1860 and 1880, with the Civil War years as a low point, about 10 million Europeans came to the United States. So talking of migration, about 15 million. They came from the British Isles, various parts of the Germans, various parts of the German-speaking region, which in 1871 would become Germany. They came from parts of the Austro-Hungarian Empire, particularly Bohemia, from Sweden, Norway, Denmark, okay, and Ireland. Okay, now it's important to note that I give these names of these countries, like Sweden, Norway, Denmark, and so on, but let's keep in mind that these were regionally specific migrations. It wasn't that all Swedes came or from that all regions of Sweden were uniformly represented, but basically those regions which had the oldest agriculture, in which land was the most expensive, okay, and which were closest to means of transportation, where there was greatest economic development, sent the most immigrants. So somebody living in a long-developed agricultural region who had some access to some means of conveyance to get them to a port was more likely to come than somebody living in a less developed region where land was cheaper, okay, and who had less access to transportation. The single largest sender in this period were the German-speaking regions. Germans made up again, can't really call them Germans, but immigrants from Bavaria, from up and down the Rhineland region, later on in this period from eastern Germany, so that is from Prussia, and from those parts of Prussia which had previously been Poland, made up the single largest group. As we heard yesterday, they were religiously split between Catholics, Lutherans, other Protestant denominations. After the 1840s, some of these German speakers were avowedly non-believers, having been already influenced by socialist ideology back home. Secondly, in terms of just the numbers, Ireland was the second largest sender of immigrants. Their migration to the United States was not just during the famine years of the late 1840s, which in a way, in a very dramatic and almost cataclysmic way, a quarter of the population left in a five-year period. So it's kind of staggering to think about that. But that the migration from Ireland continued well after the famine years, and indeed the numbers are much larger, although less concentrated if we look at the 1860s, 70s, 80s, and so on, as new landholding patterns in Ireland created a reality where only one son could inherit the lease on a piece of land, and only one daughter was going to get a dowry, and all other children had to, quote, particularly young women, had to, as the word went, travel. Okay, and they were traveling to America. Before the 1840s, most of the Irish who had come to America were Protestant, but by the 1840s, the balance shifted and Catholics come to outnumber Protestants. And by the time we get to the 1880s, almost all the Irish who are coming to America are Catholics and are from the South. Okay, there are three other migrations I want to mention that were part of this era from the 1820s to the 1880s to just complicate the notion that who was immigrating in this period. While Europeans certainly were the numerically predominant, it was in these years that we see nearly all of the Chinese immigration until the 20th century. So by 1860, there were already 35,000 people who had been born in China living in the United States. And I'll come back to the Chinese immigration in a few minutes. Also, with the incorporation of the Southwest, that is the area that was ceded or stolen, whatever a verb one wants to use, by the United States in the Mexican War, a large population of Mexican residents, people who had been, Mexicans now were American. We might say they didn't need to migrate. They became incorporated. But the border between the United States and Mexico was the scene of constant movement back and forth. It was a border not necessarily recognized by the individuals, families who chose to go from Mexico into the United States. So the Chinese migration is part of this period, so too migration from Mexico. And at the other border of the United States, the one from Canada, we begin to see in this period the inflow of from Quebec, of Spanish, French speakers, the Quebecois, coming into New England, going into the textile mills and other factories in that region. All of these people, regardless of where they came from, it could have been from Limerick, or it could have been from Quebec, it could have been from Bohemia, or it could have been from Bavaria. All of this migration was bound for the United States because of the dynamism of the economy. It was an economy that was growing. The vast expansion of U.S. control of the continent starting right after the American Revolution. In the time period that we're looking at, the California Gold Rush was an enormous boon, not only for those thinking they were going to actually get gold out of the creeks, but more importantly for the development of the California economy and agriculture, mining, and beyond. During the Civil War, the Homestead Act, again, I've mentioned the Mexican War of 1848, the development of the Transcontinental Railroad, all of these were vast stimuli to the American economy. This was the age of the Great Transportation Revolution, in which canals, roads, railroads, all linked agricultural regions to cities, all facilitating the development of every sector of the nation. And the 1820s represents the beginning in serious ways of industry in America. So if I had to choose, in fact, one event to highlight this, I want to look at, very quickly, the 1825 opening of the Erie Canal. Just, kind of one event. It linked Central Europe with the American Midwest through the port of New York. Imagine, okay, goods, agricultural goods, iron ore, timber, other raw materials went from the Midwest onto boats over the Great Lakes, across the Erie Canal, down the Hudson River to the port of New York, and this is when New York takes off. Into the port of New York, onto ships that made their way across Europe to European port cities, then onto trains and into the European interior. This powerfully calibrated network brought cheap raw goods to Europeans, ironically undercutting local production in Europe. Okay, so it became cheaper, for example, less expensive for a baker in some Hungarian city to bake bread with wheat from Kansas than to bake bread with wheat from the countryside there, creating a market for American good, for American raw materials, but therefore destroying the local economy, sending millions of young people around Europe and elsewhere off their land and off the out of the traditional economy, and we might say it sent them onto those same trains that had brought the wheat. The immigrants get on those same trains, which took them then to those port cities and onto those same boats, onto the Atlantic, going from not west to east but east to west, making their way to the United States. This obviously has tremendous global implications, and it were implications that were very keenly recognized by, for example, those individuals who owned sail ship lines. Okay, and then later on by the 1870s, steamship lines, who realized they could make a tremendous profit filling up those ships with people, okay, the ships that had brought iron ore from the Mesabi range of Minnesota could be filled up on their return journey with human beings bound to the Mesabi iron range to become miners. So we see this kind of clearly, again, articulated global network. So the Black Ball Line, founded in 1818 in Liverpool, provides a case in point. So here we see globalization at work. Okay, well, let me continue a little bit with this dynamic which propelled the migration. Migration, let's say, to Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, Colorado, and elsewhere, these places wanted people, and they wanted white people. Without people, they could neither experience economic growth nor could they achieve statehood. The two were connected. They had no desire to let matters take their own course, and so these states began to send agents to Europe, going from one hot region to another, putting up posters, distributing leaflets, going into local saloons and buying rounds of drinks for the young men who are congregating in their and not just talking up the idea of America, but talking up the idea of Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, Colorado. That is, they were trying to direct this migration to very specific people. And very attractive for these young men and for the young women as well, who I will say something about since they're crucial in this, convincing them of the benefits of precisely those places. To some degree, those states and territories didn't need to have those agents because America fever was sweeping Europe anyhow. As some people left, some family members, some friends who went to America and to Colorado, Nebraska, Iowa, Minnesota, and the like, they sent letters back home. And again, the technology of transport of communication was so important, the development of the mail. It seems like a totally unrelated phenomenon. It was absolutely crucial. And the letters that came from immigrants to their families back home not only contained maybe hyperbolic statements about how fabulous everything was, but it usually contained money as well. Okay. And those, one oral history about Ireland said a woman who'd come to the United States sent back to her father in a letter a picture, her own picture. She'd had her picture taken, and the father is quoted as saying, "I didn't want her picture. I knew what she looked like. The picture I wanted was George Washington." Okay, and not because he was such a great patriot, but obviously George was on the dollar bill. So what we see are these chain migrations facilitated by remittances to get people to go to Nebraska, Minnesota, Iowa, and Colorado, as well as to New York and Baltimore and Chicago and so on. The United States as a nation did relatively little until the end of this era to put up obstacles to migration. We can say, in fact, they made it possible in as much as it was the government that financed canals, roads, railroads, territorial acquisition, land grants. Even the Mexican War and the Indian Wars were essentially gifts by the federal government to the American people as ways to make possible territorial expansion, to open up vast regions for agriculture, mining, industry, and the like. So there was no federal policy vis-a-vis immigration. The nation began, in fact, in 1790, one of the first acts of the new U.S. Congress was the Naturalization Act, which is terribly important. This act offered the right of naturalization to any free white person. It's very explicit. Okay, now, a person was defined as man. Okay, only men could become naturalized, but they had to be free, and they had to be white. There were stipulations about having good character, and the good character would be attested when that individual would apply for naturalization and then for citizenship. Now, it's notable that New York and Massachusetts and South Carolina, as early as the 1780s, and these were major ports, began to worry about not any particular group of immigrants that is defined by name or by the name of their group, but they were worried about indigent foreigners being dumped, okay, that's, you know, the word they used, on their wharves. And over the course of the next decades, these states, New York in particular, was very aggressive about passing laws, putting a burden on the ship's captains to prove that the individuals that they were carrying were not going to become charges to the community. New York and other states in particular worried about a class of immigrant called assisted immigrants. Okay, so assisted immigrants were people, women and men, whose local governments, the local parishes from which they came, their landlords, charitable societies in Europe, paid their way to get them out, okay, because those parishes and governments didn't want them to be public charges either, okay, back in a particular village in Sweden, a particular town in Ireland, and the like. In 1847, the New York legislature established for the first time in any state a board of the Board of Commissioners of Emigration, and the commissioners were there to both protect and regulate. They set up the first immigrant receiving station. This was in 1855 at the tip of Lower Manhattan, which maybe some of you have visited, Castle Garden. It was originally Castle Clinton. It had been a fort from the War of 1812. And known as the emigrant, and interestingly, the word emigrant rather than immigrant tended to predominate, known as the emigrant landing depot, vast numbers of European immigrants came through Castle Clinton or through Castle Garden. Now, what's important about this is not only the beginnings of regulation and the fear of indigency and the fear of dependency and the fact that they didn't want anyone to be a public charge, is that the state of New York appropriated hardly any funds for the maintenance of Castle Garden, and very few people were appointed. There were very few bureaucrats were appointed to make sure this actually worked. We can take the lack of funding. Okay, I think anytime there's a legislation passed, but there's no money attached to it, maybe we could talk to the congressman about this. It says something, right? They're trying to satisfy some constituency that's worried about a problem, but not so worried that they want to spend money on it. Okay, so the fact that they expended allocated very little money for this indicated that nativist sentiment, and I will come to that in a second, was in the main outweighed by a kind of optimistic sense that immigrants were pretty good for the economy, and they would become productive Americans in a relatively short period of time, and that the new nation could integrate the newcomers. Okay, but by and large, the borders were unregulated. Large numbers of Irish immigrants, for example, the poorest of the Irish immigrants, actually came on the most inexpensive route, okay, travel route, which took them to Quebec. Okay, and from Quebec, however, they just drifted down the border by foot, by wagon, by barge, and entered the United States, fanning out to the Midwest, to upstate New York, into New York City, along the East Coast, but they're uncounted. We don't know who they were. They were unenumerated. They just showed up. So too, on the Mexican side, there was no supervision or no infrastructure to count, to send back people, because there just was not this kind of a system. This benign regulation of European immigrants and even those coming from Mexico stands in direct contrast to the treatment of the Chinese in this period. And here we can see race at work. I'm just going to rattle off a few dates as a kind of harbinger of what's going to come. In 1854, the Supreme Court of California, in a case called People v. Hall, said that no Chinese person could testify in court against a white person. Okay, in 1858, the California legislature prohibited by name immigration of Mongolian and Chinese individuals. Okay, again, with though very little sort of mechanism to supervise this. In 1862, during the Civil War, the United States specifically banned coolie labor. Coolie was a euphemism for Chinese contract labor. In 1870, the Naturalization Act barred Chinese from ever attaining citizenship. Okay, it prevented the immigration of Chinese women who had husbands in the United States, and Chinese and Japanese men had to show evidence if they were bringing in a woman that she was of high moral character and that they would support her. In 1875, the Page Act barred Chinese, Japanese, and Mongolian prostitutes, felons, and contract labor. In 1878, in a case for the U.S. Supreme Court, In Re Yop, the Chinese were defined as people utterly ineligible for citizenship. And this culminates then in 1882 in the Chinese Exclusion Act. Okay, well, where did they go? What did they do once they got in the United States? Now, certainly a number of them did go into American agriculture, and probably more than in any other period, there was a movement of immigrants to farming, Scandinavians, some from the British Isles, some of the Germans, some of the Czech immigrants tended to go in to the American agricultural regions, taking up farms that Americans had abandoned, thinking they were unproductive, and using European techniques of much more intensive agriculture were able to make them productive. Because the agricultural migration was relatively small, and that may help us understand why so many or so few immigrants actually went to the South, because before the Civil War, certainly they could never compete with farms based on slave labor, and afterwards could not compete with plantations that used sharecroppers and tenant farmers. But most, as I said, most did not go into cities. Most, like those who had come after the 1880s, were bound for industry. They went into mill work, to factory work of all kinds, mining. Wherever mining cropped up, there were immigrant laborers. A small community like Mineral Point, Wisconsin, okay, was made up almost completely of immigrants from Cornwall and Wales. Okay, and they, by the way, had very separate social lives. The Cornish were in some institute had their institutions, the Welsh had theirs. This was a migration to cities, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, Chicago. It was a migration in the Northeast to the textile mills of Lawrence, Lowell, Pawtucket, Fall River, in which Europeans took over and French Canadians took over the places at the looms, abandoned by young white farm girls, Protestants from the surrounding rural region, who decided they didn't want to do this any longer for all sorts of reasons. Some of these were skilled laborers, particularly among the British and the Germans, but large numbers, elusive to us, were unskilled. They went into manual labor, railroad crews, canal building, and the like. Over time, some of these immigrants, as would be true, if I was writing this, this would be in capital letters, as would be true with every immigration down to the ones of people coming in today, some of them went into entrepreneurship. They opened stores, shops, provided for fee services to both their own community and to the larger population of the cities and towns where they lived. Some of them put packs on their backs as peddlers and went out to the frontier communities, into the isolated farms, into the mines, selling in their halting and minimal English goods to the American men and women who decided they could move out to Oregon or they could move out to Nebraska and live on farms because somebody with a pack on their back was willing to come and bring them eyeglasses and buttons and needles and thread, and those people were immigrants. The immigrants of this period, those who didn't go into entrepreneurship but remained in industry, did get bumped up the ladder. Okay, not by virtue of acquiring amassing capital, or not by virtue of education, but as new immigrants came in, those who were there before got to move up into more skilled and supervisory positions. Two particular cases that I think need, in terms of work, that need to be made explicit, which again, it tells us something about how immigrants were integrating into American society and what this immigration meant for them. For the Irish, gaining control of municipal services in the cities to which they went as they began to swell the ranks of the police, fire departments, sanitation workers, laying of gas and sewer lines, all new municipal projects, gave them a real niche in the American economy. Okay, and one that their own political machine in New York, exemplified by Tammany Hall, used as a kind of ethnic leverage. And so the Tammany Hall decided who would be a policeman. Okay, an Irish recruited other Irish, or who would be a sanitation worker, Irish recruited Irish, and so on. Everything I've said so far has been very male-dominated, and we should keep in mind that women were part of this migration also. And for many of the women, the allure of America was the ability to make a living, and for them, domestic service was a very important magnet. Throughout much of the country, it was Irish women who were in the main, young, single women who'd migrated on their own, went into domestic service. In the Midwest, it was Scandinavian women who were doing these jobs, some German women, they used domestic service as a way to finance their migrations. Okay, well, this is made clear also where they went. They didn't go to the South, but particularly to the cities, Baltimore, New Orleans, Charleston, and to river towns like St. Louis and Louisville. All of these cities had substantial German and Irish populations, but most went to the large cities of the East Coast. They fanned out to the newly created cities of the interior, Cincinnati, St. Louis, Milwaukee, Detroit, Chicago, which in the 1840s were frontier villages, and this immigrant population helped make these the big cities became. Now, whichever group we talk about, wherever they went, they all went through the process of creating communities based on place of origin. Every group, it could be Cornish, okay, it could be Polish. The experience was the same. It could be Chinese or French Canadian. Every group of men and women from someplace outside the United States built their lives around the languages that they knew and the places of origin from which they had come. Places of worship, boarding houses, newspapers, grocery stores, schools, benefit associations, charitable societies, social clubs, political clubs, parochial schools, all were the product of these immigrant communities. They advocated politically not only for their place in the United States, but created political entities in order to advocate for their homeland, causes in their homeland. Now, notably, Americans, again, it's an ambiguous group, didn't like some of what they saw. The Irish, they said, drank too much. The Germans drank a lot also. They didn't like that. And they spoke German in public. The Quebecois kept going back to French Canada. And who knew if they were going to actually stay? And they were making no commitment to the nation. The Jews were too clannish, okay, and so on. What the complaints were in some ways did not matter very much. The fact is they were being complained about. Now, I want to move into xenophobia, which will be the conclusion of my talk, but I do want to say that there was a degree of tolerance in this period for difference that may not have been seen in decades to come. So a number of cities, places like Buffalo, Milwaukee, Cincinnati, and so on, actually allowed for the teaching of in elementary and high school of the curriculum in German. Okay, so here we have the first experience of Americans with bilingual education. Okay, something that in the 1970s and 80s was viewed as a kind of devilish idea. In the 1850s and 60s, one could be a child in a German family living in Buffalo and having a German education paid for by the public schools of Buffalo. There were, in this period, particularly among the agricultural communities, all German, all Swedish, all Czech communities in which the languages persisted well into the second decade. And in general, Americans had an idea that the American culture was tolerant enough and open enough that they would all, in the words of Ralph Waldo Emerson, enter into the American smelting pot, and in it would be forged a new American. Okay. Xenophobia, that is the hatred or the fear of foreigners. Well, first, I want to deal with the issue of race and color. Now, clearly, color was the most important variable because every single law that I articulated or that I rattled off to you about the Chinese had no replica in the legislative agenda vis-a-vis European immigrants. Okay, and what made the Chinese different? Was a phenotype. Okay, and in this way, despite the writings of many of my fellow historians who are interested in the evolution of a concept called whiteness, all European immigrants were white. Okay, people may have had scurrilous things to say about them, but they were all white in as much as they were all capable of being naturalized. They could all go into a court and testify against someone else. They could create the kinds of communities and families they wanted. They could enter into court, into contracts. They knew they would be protected by the state. But having said that, xenophobia was a force in American life. And here I just want to look at a few categories and then close. So probably the most important aspect of xenophobia in this period was directed at Catholicism. So anti-Catholicism, which might be in the 19th century the equivalent, okay, and I'm going to probably be going out on a limb here, and you can tell me that, the equivalent of the hatred and fear of Islam in contemporary America. Anti-Catholicism shaped American life. It was a legacy of the Protestant Reformation. The general belief among most Americans was that Catholics and Catholicism was alien to American values. The Pope was the great enemy of modernity, individualism, and democracy. The know-nothings who we heard about last night were pretty successful. They captured state legislatures and city councils. They tried to put in place all sorts of anti-immigrant measures, tended to be relatively unsuccessful in the end. There was vast street action against Catholic churches. Convents were burnt down. And you had Bloody Monday here in Louisville. Priests and nuns were attacked on the street. The Irish were viewed as stupid, drunken, slavish followers of the Pope who told them what to do. And as such, they and their churches and the Catholic schools the parochial schools that they built, were the enemies of American liberty. We might say that, in fact, some of the most profound changes in American life were attributable to the American fear of the Irish and the Irish as Catholics. So, for example, the temperance movement, which culminates in the Prohibition Amendment to the Constitution, was out in its origins a sense that the Irish were too, not only addicted to or slavish to the Pope, but slavish to the bottle, and that they had to be weaned from it. If they couldn't be convinced to give it up, it had to be taken away from them. So too, the American system of public education was very much shaped by the idea that Catholicism and the Irish needed to be civilized, and as Horace Mann, the great philosopher and activist in public education in Massachusetts, envisioned the public school would wean the Irish from being Irish. Again, thinking about Congressman Yarmouth's words about children being taken away from their parents, in the mid-19th century in New York and some of the other large cities, Protestant-based child welfare services, not the state, but Christian organizations like the Children's Aid Society in New York, actually, with the cooperation of the courts, would find orphans and other street waifs or children who they believed their parents couldn't take care of them, and would essentially send them west, okay, and place them with specifically Protestant families in Iowa or Kansas or Nebraska and the like, and assume that if they lived in this beneficent Protestant environment, all of their bad traits would be blanched out of them, and they could become Americans. So at heart, there was this fear of Catholicism. There was a fear of labor of foreign radicals. And the Irish again play a very important role in stimulating the American concerns. In the 1870s, the Molly Maguires were an important labor group in the Pennsylvania coal region, deeply connected to Irish nationalism. They were viewed as a terrorist organization. There were economic fears, know-nothingism peaked and waned with the ups and downs of the mercurial mid-19th century American economy. When times got bad, anti-Catholic, anti-Irish sentiment soared. When times got a little better, it tended to quiet down a bit. Okay, race was obviously here also, inasmuch as the Irish, the Jews, the Germans were thought of as groups of people who had inherent characteristics, but they, because they were white, could be made into something else. So the young Irish Catholic child swooped off the streets of New York and sent to Iowa could become American and wholesome and productive. Okay, but color outweighed everything else, and here we see the origins, ultimately, of Chinese exclusion. So to draw this to a close, it was a period of tremendous change in America. It saw the vast conquest and settlement of the continent and the beginnings of the Industrial Revolution. Those two developments would have never taken place if millions of people from villages and towns in Central Europe, the British Isles, China, Mexico, French Canada, had not decided that the circumstances of their lives would never get better if they stayed put, and that the dynamism of the American economy offered them the best option to get on with their lives. One writer from the early 19th century described America as an ordinary man who had letters somehow survived. He wrote back to his family in England, and he said America was the best poor man's country. Okay. Well, this era of the best poor man's country was one which set in motion America as an immigrant magnet, and it also set in motion the complicated relationships that Americans have had with immigration from that day until today. So thank you. Okay, so I'll sit down.
We do questions?
Oh, okay. Okay, great. And you'll let me know when. Okay, great. Yes, sir.
What was the percentage of men and women?
Of men versus women?
Yes.
Okay, so the Irish were the one group in which women outnumbered men. Okay, and that became more sort of clear, more predominant after the 1850s. Okay, for most other groups, because this tended to be, and again, it's really hard to say because each group was somewhat different, most groups tended to be fairly equal men and women, in as much as these were primarily migrations of either families or young people, young men who would come to the United States first, earn some money, save it, and then be able to marry. So had they stayed put, that was one of the things that they couldn't do because they had no way to support a family. So that while many of the immigrant ships, and there are no records, by the way, so this is before any documentation, men were more likely to be the first ones in their families to come, but over time, okay, they were able to, women arrived. But among the Irish and at some points among Scandinavians, very heavily female. Okay, so in some ways the Irish are not unlike many of the contemporary groups. So, for example, among some of the, I think, Jamaicans and from the Philippines, very heavily, and some of the West Indies now, very heavily female migration. So it's a kind of similarity in that way. Yes, sir.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay. Yes, and so so there are various forms of indenturitude. That, too, has a degree of voluntarism in it on two levels. So first, the indentured servant, and again, since you indicated there were different forms of it, made a decision back home. Okay, I'm going to do this. Okay, that's going to be the way that I can get over there. They had other options also. They could have gone to the cities in their own country. Okay, so there's a choice. Secondly, the indenturitude brought with it a contract. And once somebody has a contract, it specifies not only responsibilities, but it specified their rights. Okay, for the involuntary immigrants, there's no contract. Okay, and there's no assumption or reality of rights. Now, the idea of contract labor was pretty repugnant to Americans. And again, the Naturalization Act of 1790 had said free white persons. And so there was a kind of sense that contract labor maybe bordered on slavery. And so one of the early post-1880 acts, so not in my time period, was the Foran Act, which banned contract labor. And this was directed heavily at, for example, among Italians. It was very common for a labor agent, somebody from the group, going into a village and creating these labor contracts with townsmen and saying, okay, you know, you're going to be working for me. And Americans viewed this as on the border of slavery. And so in a way compromising the freedom. And that word freedom really resonated a lot with Americans. Okay. Yes. Okay, so, I mean, it was a period, I would say, of pretty benign neglect. I mean, it just didn't care. There was relatively little anti-Semitism. Jews experienced probably more than any other immigrant group in this period economic mobility and trajectory from having arrived as poor peddlers to becoming, some of them became phenomenally wealthy, but most became just sort of modestly successful shopkeepers. But that, in the context of the 19th century, was a tremendous move upward. It was for them really the first time that they were able to engage with their religion as they wanted, okay, without any, the state couldn't care less what they were doing religiously. And that was really a very important moment. And so the Know-Nothings had nothing to say about the Jews. Okay, now, their numbers were too small, whereas the Irish numbers were enormous, but they really had nothing to say about Jews as a potential threat. Oh, yes. Okay, so question, rates of acquisition of citizenship. So, you know, we don't have good figures because there's no enumeration of who's coming. And so we have to kind of guess. And there are naturalization records. And how to compare that to the population as a whole is not so easy. But by and large, they did acquire citizenship at a fairly rapid rate from everything we know because they saw citizenship not, again, not because they had this kind of lyrical view of America and American freedom, but it had very practical consequences for being able to participate politically and to advocate for their own interests.
So how did they apply that?
Well, they So if one, after one could become, if you could become naturalized, and again, all white European men could become naturalized, go to a court, declare intention to become naturalized. It was originally 2 years, and then it was extended to 5 years. After 5 years, they could come and take an oath in which they declared that they were no longer a subject of King George, or whatever king, Queen Victoria, that is, whoever was the ruler of the land they had come from, that they renounce all loyalty to that other country, and that they were now Americans. The political machine, Tammany Hall in New York, but its equivalent in other cities, played a very important role in helping immigrants get naturalized. During the Civil War, any man who was willing to, any immigrant who was willing to join the army got immediate citizenship. Now, obviously, women did not become citizens, because for one thing, they couldn't vote, and so there was no point in being a citizen. It was by world standards. Okay, the standards, let's say, comparing it to Europe, to England, it was very easy to become an American citizen, again, so long as one was a white man. Okay, and I saw one other hand up. Yes, sir?
My grandmother, living in Germany, had an out-of-wedlock child, and when her family was coming here, her parents passed them off as theirs. Uh-huh.
Well, now again, remember, this is much later. I assume your mother didn't come before 1880, but yes, because, so by then the mechanism of regulation, the mechanism of questioning, and the possibility, the threat of detention and sending back was already in place. And so people created all sorts of fictitious relationship stories about themselves in order to be able to get into the United States. But it's, in a sense, that development, which is a post-1880s, that makes this period that I was talking about different, in as much as the mechanism was just not there. Yes, sir. And Judy, did you give me a... Oh, okay.
It seems like immigration from England was declined relatively during that interval. Why was that?
Because of their own economic development, the excess population, people who were no longer able to be supported on the land, had tremendous opportunities in going to Manchester, Liverpool, Birmingham, wherever, to the enormous expansion of factories there. And remember, Britain has this massive empire. And so Britain is producing huge amounts of finished products to go to India and to go, you know, to all of their colonial holdings. So their industrial revolution was, maturation was fueled by their empire. So there was no need, whereas these other places weren't experiencing at the same rate that kind of industrial development. And basically every place where immigration begins to dwindle was connected to the maturation of the economy there and the ability of those societies to provide work for people who could no longer be supported by agriculture. So yes, that's an excellent question. And again, it shows us this sort of connection that the back there and the here were completely connected with each other in terms of who left and when and why and how. Okay. Oh, yes, sir. Okay, and what's important is not just, again, by that time period, it's not just that they were citizens, and that they, I mean, particularly if they were killed, they couldn't enjoy the benefits of it, but their families back home, that is, their wives, their children, were automatically Americans, had the right to come as the dependents of an American, as American citizens. So acquisition of citizenship became more important as the mechanism of regulation became more intense. Okay, yes. Okay, thank you.